I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In 1934, Franklin Roosevelt established a committee on economic security. And the purpose for establishing the committee was to develop a comprehensive social insurance system covering all major personal economic hazards with a special emphasis on unemployment and old age insurance. Subsequently, we had Social Security in this country, and we celebrated the 79th anniversary of Social Security on August 14. The latest report of the Social Security trustees shows currently there's $2.7 trillion in the trust fund held in Treasury bonds. The program is taking in more revenues than it's paying out. The trust fund will continue to grow, but long about 2033, we're going to encounter some problems. So what do we do about those? How substantial are the problems? Why do we have Social Security? What's the history of Social Security? We figured with this big birthday, 79 years, that this would be a good time to talk about Social Security. And I think we're going to have a lot of response to the topic. Dean Baker is our guest. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, writes a weekly column for The Guardian Unlimited, The Huffington Post, Truth Out, and he has a blog, Beat the Press, which features commentary on economic reporting. He's the author of a number of books, including Getting Back to Full Employment. He has worked as a consultant for the World Bank, the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress, and done many other things in his career. We welcome phone calls. What do you think about the future of Social Security? What do you think about Social Security? Do you like it? Are you getting Social Security? Do you look forward to getting it? We'd love to hear from you, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Hi, Dean. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me on.
So what was FDR thinking back in 1935?
Well, he was thinking that it would be good if working people in the United States had some security in their old age. At that point, most people had very little by way of any sort of retirement savings, defined benefit pensions, if you're very lucky, but they were still very much a rarity. Essentially, in people's old age, they would be in poverty or be with their kids. That was essentially the options. And Roosevelt felt, you know, that we could do better. There, you know, most other countries, other wealthy countries at that point, much less wealthy than they are today. But in any case, other countries had systems like Social Security. I think Germany, I could be wrong on this, maybe one of your listeners will correct me, but Germany under Bismarck, I believe, was the first to put this in back in the 1870s.
Oh, my.
So, you know, the idea that we would have some sort of governmental pension that people would pay into during their working years and would provide them with sort of a minimal standard of living in their retirement, that was happening other places. And, you know, Roosevelt thought we could and should do it here. And, you know, it's been hugely popular ever since he created it. Not to say people didn't oppose it. I mean, there were a lot of opponents then. There have been opponents throughout its existence. But the fact is the program has been enormously popular. Basically, because it's done what it was intended. It provides a core retirement income for people who spent their life working. And, you know, no one gets rich on it. Very little fraud. The administrative costs are very low. So in a lot of ways, it's really been a model program. And, you know, for that reason, I think it is hugely valued by most people in the country.
And you talk about some opposition to it. Was there vast opposition to it? It must have sparked some really vigorous debate, because when you think about it, it's a pretty radical idea in some ways. I mean, a good idea. A lot of people embraced it, but I would think that there was a lot of dissent. Was it, or am I overstating how much there was?
No, there was absolutely a lot of dissent. You know, if you think back to our debate over Obamacare, which I guess still is not over, you know, a lot of it was the same sort of issue. Should the government be involved in this? Is it the government's role to be guaranteeing people retirement security? So that was a very big issue. I should also point out there was a lot of issues about the coverage, because as it stands now, most of the public, the only substantial group that's not covered, is you have a number of state and local employees. Roughly a third of state and local employees still aren't covered by Social Security. But when it was first put in place, the question was who would be covered. And there were a lot of groups. It was written explicitly to exclude, particularly agricultural workers, domestic workers. Disproportionately, it excluded jobs that where workers tend to be women and also African-Americans. So these were very contentious issues, and it was deliberately crafted, I'm not saying by Roosevelt, but this was a compromise that they ended up with a program that, at least in its first years, largely excluded the jobs that African-Americans tend to work at.
Hmm. And so has it changed markedly since 79 years ago or not?
Well, it has in a few ways. I mean, first thing, it has broadened out, as I said, to be nearly universal. The only substantial group of workers still not covered are state and local employees. It's up to state and local governments. If they have a pension, they don't have to also have Social Security. So there's still a number of state and local employees. So it's expanded to cover most of the workforce. The benefits have gotten somewhat more generous. I don't want to overplay that, but there was some increase in benefits over, you know, pretty much entirely the decades from 1937 till the early 70s. Since then, the benefit level's actually gotten somewhat less generous. We've increased the retirement age, so that makes it less generous. We also added the disability program. That was not originally part of Social Security. It was added in the early 50s, if I remember my dates right there. So that also was added on. Again, part of the point being that we want to provide people with income security, and you could think of it sometimes it's referred to as old age and disability insurance. So, you know, it's guaranteeing if, you know, I live a long life, all of us hope to live a long life, I assume. So, you know, we'll have some income to support us in our later years. Disability, the same story. If something mm-hmm. happens to us at the workplace, we aren't able to work, it provides at least a minimal income to support us. And, you know, in many cases, people still have children, people they're supporting. So it provides additional support for dependents.
And now, is it a program that's embraced by most countries all over the world or not?
It's certainly all the wealthy countries have a Social Security system, and most developing countries have a Social Security system. Now, the big difference in developing countries is that you still have large informal sectors. So if we look to Latin America, you have oftentimes 30%, 40%, even 50% of the workers who don't have formal employment, meaning they don't have an employer that's sending, giving them a paycheck every month and sending in taxes to the government. So you often have large informal sectors, and by their nature, those workers tend not to be covered by the Social Security programs that exist in those countries. So across West Europe, you know, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all these countries have Social Security systems. Again, Latin America, you'll find them, but the people that are enrolled in the Social Security system tend to be the formal sector workers, which would exclude a lot of the population.
Uh-huh. So let's look at now. You released a report on the latest report of the Social Security trustees, looking at how healthy everything is now and when we might start anticipating some issues and how we're going to handle those issues. Right now, though, it would be safe to say, wouldn't it, that we're taking in more revenue than we're paying out?
Absolutely. There's a trust fund. The trust fund currently has about $2.7 trillion in reserves. And if you add in the interest that we're getting on those reserves, these are bonds, government bonds are held by the trust fund. So you add in the interest from those bonds and the payroll taxes that people are paying in each month, that adds up to about $100 billion more than what's being paid out in benefits each year, a little bit more than that. That gets a little bit more. So the trust fund's actually growing year by year, and it's projected to continue to grow until, forget whether it's 2022 or 2023. After that point, assuming nothing changes, you know, in other words, assuming the projections are on the mark and there's no changes in the law, then we start running down the trust fund. And as it currently stands, the trust fund would be depleted in the most recent projections, 2033. So it's not, you know, fully sound. I should point out, even when the trust fund's depleted, we'd still have enough coming in revenue to pay about 75% of benefits. That wouldn't be a good story. We want to see that. But the point is that it doesn't go to zero, so it's not as though if, you know, we just don't pay any attention to it, we get to 2033, suddenly no one's getting anything. They'd be getting 75% of their benefits. You wouldn't want to see anyone cut like that. But the point is it's not as though there's no money at that point. Not enough to pay full benefits, but it's very far from zero.
So part of the problem is it that there are so many people in the baby boom generation that we have to pay out a lot because of that population bulge?
That's a big part of it. But the point, the two other points to go along with it is that, on the one hand, we're living longer, so it's not just that there are more baby boomers. Life expectancies have been increasing. The other part, and this is important, that we've seen low wage growth over the last three decades. Now, that's not the whole story by any means, but it's an important part of it because that's had two effects. One is the more rapid wages grow, the more money gets paid each year relative to the benefits that are paid out. That's simply the revenue that comes in is a percentage of wages, and if wages grow more rapidly, we're getting more in relative to what gets paid out. So that's one part of the story. The other part is because there's been an upward redistribution within the wage structure, so that the larger share of wages are going to workers, higher paid workers, the percentage that's covered, that's subject to the tax, has been falling. Currently, the cap on the payroll tax is roughly $117,000. If we go back to 1983, the last time there were major changes in the program, the Greenspan Commission, Bipartisan Commission, produced a set of changes, they set the cap at a level where only 10% of wage income was over the cap, meaning it wasn't subject to the tax. Currently, it's about 18% of wage income. So that's been another factor that's hurt the finances of the program, bringing forward the date when we first might face a shortfall and making it somewhat worse than it would otherwise be.
And, Dean, what's the story with the cap? You say in the report, I think this is true, that many Americans don't realize that there is a cap of $117,000. Why was that made a part of the program? To sell it?
Well, the idea, a couple things. One was it was to focus more on middle-income workers, so it was about providing retirement income for middle-income workers rather than, you know, high-end workers will still get something back from Social Security, but, you know, odds are, you know, Bill Gates' Social Security isn't going to be as much to
right. I would think so.
Yeah. So it's, you know, so it was to focus on middle-income and moderate-income workers, of course. The other part is that when you get to really high incomes, it is hard to actually impose that tax because it's important to keep in mind it's a wage tax. So it may not be hard to tax someone at $200,000, $250,000, $300,000. But when we get up to people earning millions of dollars, a lot of these people have good ways to hide their income. So in some sense, I think it was a recognition of the reality that if we didn't have any cap at all, that when you got to the very high-income people, they probably would find ways to avoid the tax. They could have their income appear as profits, as, you know, they could incorporate and have the income go to a corporation and never have it show up as wage income subject to the tax.
So what are the ideas for raising or phasing out the cap, and is there one that you want to start with that you think is the best idea?
Well, I think raising the cap so we again cover 90% of wage income. I mean, if you go back to 83, this is a bipartisan commission chaired by Alan Greenspan. They thought that 90% target was reasonable. The reason we're not there today is there's been so much upward redistribution that, you know, much more income goes over the cap. So I think, you know, saying, okay, 90% was reasonable in 83 to this bipartisan commission, let's get back to 90%. It doesn't have to be overnight, but to get it up there, you know, raise it in increments, 90%, I'd have to double-check where it would get us today, but probably a little over 200,000. So if you were to raise that in increments of 10,000 a year or so, that would get you there in about 8 years. So I think that would be, you know, perfectly reasonable thing to do, consistent with the history of the program, consistent with what, you know, this commission thought was a reasonable strategy 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I found the statistics interesting, and I'm wondering if they would be very, very different 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You break it down by state, so this is, I never knew this. In Wisconsin, 76,743 men make over $117,000. 24,558 women do. And then when you look at making over $250,000, one of the proposals deals with that number. We'll talk about it. 28,462 men and 7,568 women. Is that a whole lot more than 10 years ago?
The numbers would be somewhat more, not hugely more. I mean, the big thing is that each of those people has a lot more money. So it's not so much that we have so many more people who are earning over the cap. It's that the people that are earning over the cap have much more money today than they did, you know, say, 10 or 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So that over $250,000 for some of those people would be wildly over $250,000.
Exactly. You've got people earning, you know, $5 million, $10 million. So, yeah, so they're quite a bit over that cutoff.
Dean Baker is our guest this hour. We're celebrating the 79th anniversary of Social Security and talking about what's ahead for this program. Dean is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. Our phone lines, I guarantee you, will be jammed. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. You have a chance to get in right now, 800-486-8655, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Social Security, this hour of the show, with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and we start our calls with Gino in Milwaukee. Hi, Gino.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I was, I heard on one of the radio programs a while ago that actually Social Security is one of the largest holders of U.S. debt, you know, more than China. And when it comes time to repay that money with the interest, won't the taxpayer, because we do run deficits, have to kick in more in their taxes? So this almost seems like Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, and in buying U.S. debt and the government running on that money, more like a double Ponzi scheme. I really wish we would have got Al Gore, where he would have had his lockbox and kept all that Social Security money stuffed under the bed or something. I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Dean.
Well, Social Security is in effect a separate account. So, and you know, a lot of reporters, I think, are fairly inexact in how they treat Social Security. So, basically, Social Security should be thought of as being like if you or I had a pension at our workplace and invested exclusively in government bonds. So the pension, while we're working, while you and I are working, it's investing in government bonds. Now, at some point, you know, we expect to retire and we want our pension paid. And to pay that, it's going to sell those bonds. That's exactly the story with Social Security. Now, it's not increasing our indebtedness because we already owed the money. So paying off the bonds that are held by Social Security, we get other bonds, and you know our indebtedness isn't changed. So you may recall we had a big fight over the debt ceiling a couple of years ago. Well, Social Security was included in that. Social Security, the money that we lend to Social Security, the bonds, I mean we borrow from Social Security, the bonds that are held by Social Security, is part of the debt covered by the debt ceiling. So in that sense, if we say what's the total debt of the U.S. government, that doesn't change if Social Security, say, sells off $1 billion in bonds and we replace them with $1 billion of other bonds. We've already borrowed the money. It's just changing it. It's, you know, like we borrow it from, you know, Bill Gates instead of from, you know, the Chinese government. We still owe the money just the same. So it's not really, there's not really any Ponzi scheme here. It's all, you know, it's all on the books. And, you know, one of the things I get a kick out of is people say the government's hiding the deficit with Social Security. Every budget document I know has the deficit, you know, written with including the money borrowed from Social Security. So any reporter, whoever says that, or any politician for that matter who says that, is really being disingenuous because the number's right there. I don't, you know, if you're trying to hide it, they're not doing a very good job of it.
Scott in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Since the beginning of this year, I've been working with the Monroe County Local History Room on a project to transcribe the records of the Monroe County poorhouse called the Poor Farm. Mm. And I came into this project knowing only of the poorhouse, the expression, you're going to drive me to the poorhouse, mm-hmm. having no real knowledge of what it was all about or what kind of an institution it was. And since that time, I've come to learn that prior to the poorhouse, there was a time in this country when counties would have people working for them called poor masters. And if they had somebody who couldn't take care of themselves, they would literally bid that service out to the lowest bidder. So in other words, if you would come to the poor master and say, I can take care of this family for $100 a month, and I showed up and said, I can take care of them for $80 a month, I would get the bid. Hmm. Now, because if they would be paying, the county would be paying me less to take care of these people than you would have received. Mm-hmm. Well, you can see where the possibilities for abuse in that system were manifold. So what winds up happening is they start developing these poorhouses to bundle everybody together and try and take care of those who can't take care of themselves. And I can tell you from going through these records, this was a sad, sad situation. And I've even met people in Monroe County who, as school kids, were taken as field trips to the poorhouses and have come and said they came back. It was like they described it as a scared straight experience. Mm. They just said, you know, this is no place you ever, ever want to wind up. And this very dismal institution went along for decades, and what finally put an end to the poorhouse was the New Deal, and in specific, the Social Security Act.
Is this going to be in a book, Scott?
No. What I'm doing this for, Kathleen, is the Monroe County Local History Room has it's a resource for genealogical and historical research.
I see.
And they have all kinds of indexes, court records, newspaper indexes, death records, cemetery records. And my work will, when it finally goes live, be a spreadsheet of it's actually two institutions, because there was a poorhouse, and growing out of the poorhouses happened all across the country as well, were asylums. And in the case of Monroe County, they were two buildings right next to one another. They're still out there, being used by the county health department in a different capacity. But I can tell you, just even from my vantage point, looking back over these years, peering in and seeing the descriptions, there's a column of descriptions of how and why these folks wound up in this institution. As your guests are saying, a lot of them old age, a lot of them they described at the time as feeble-minded, mm-hmm. or crippled were mm-hmm. the words they used in that time. Mm-hmm. And, and this is a year-by-year register. I've got it from 1898 to 1936. Mm. And they are very sad lives, I can just tell you. Mm. You know, God bless you, Franklin Roosevelt, for putting an end to that.
Thank you, Scott.
I think it's a fascinating account.
Yeah, it does. And I'm sure you're familiar with stories like that. And there must have been many stories like that told when this was all being created.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, point was, you know, to be old in this country, you know, again, if your family couldn't support you, you didn't have anything. You were poor. And, you know, poverty rates among seniors, you know, going back to before Social Security, they're around 50%. I mean, people, you know, if you couldn't work, you know, you're pretty much out of luck.
Thank you very much, Scott, for your call. George in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, hi. Couple of points. Perhaps I missed this in the early part of the show, but I wonder if Mr. Baker could just talk about the percentage of Social Security that goes towards SSI and disability insurance. And then my second question for him is, does he think there's a, perhaps not in the next couple of years, maybe even in the next presidential election, why not have a candidate run who would be in favor of increasing Social Security to a level in which private pensions wouldn't be as important as they had been in the past, because they pretty much have gone by the board?
Very good questions. First off, in terms of SSI, important to keep in mind, that's a separate program. So that's Supplemental Security Assistance. That's basically a poverty program that it's not dependent on what you paid into it. So there's no specific tax for Supplemental Security income. So basically people get that are generally disabled, unable to work for one reason or another. It's very low benefit levels. I think they average around $400 or $500 a month. And it doesn't depend. It's not specific. There's no designated tax for that. So unlike Social Security, which has a payroll tax we're all paying each month, there's no designated tax for SSI. It comes out of general revenue. Now, the disability program, currently the costs are roughly about a sixth of the cost of the total program, or if you want to put it the other way, about one-fifth as much as paid out to the old age and survivors program gets paid out in disability benefits. The disability program faces a shortfall. It's trust funds, which people usually talk about them together, but under the law they're treated separately. So its trust fund is projected to face a shortfall first in 2017. So there will be an issue with that. The easiest thing to do, what's been done in the past, is you simply transfer money from one fund to the other, but that's obviously something Congress will have to decide. Your second question, should there be a raise in Social Security benefits given that to replace private pensions? I think it's a very reasonable position. There have been some people, Elizabeth Warren probably the most prominent, but Tom Harkins from Iowa near you and in the Senate, others have advocated increasing Social Security benefits. To my view, I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to be talking about because this is the portion of our retirement income programs that works. So, you know, we used to talk about retirement income being a three-legged stool, the idea that people would have a pension, a defined contribution pension, they'd have some retirement savings, they would have their Social Security, and Social Security was just one leg of that stool. Well, as it stands, defined benefit pensions are vanishing rapidly in the private sector. They're going down very quickly, mm-hmm. and even in the public sector, they're being cut back. So not many people still have defined benefit pensions. The defined contribution 401ks, they just really haven't worked. People have not accumulated very much in most cases. They tend to have high administrative costs. A lot of people end up cashing their money out when they change jobs. It's unfortunate, but they do that. So that hasn't been very successful. And private savings have been very, very weak. So arguably, you could say Social Security is the portion of the program that's worked. Why don't we expand that? And again, you do have some politicians who are saying that, I think it's a reasonable thing to do. I understand it's a cost. I mean, there's nothing free here, so we're going to have to look to finding the revenue to cover that at some point. But, I think it's fair to say this is the portion of the retirement system that's working.
And what about, you talked about how there hasn't been fraud. Things are running just fine with Social Security. The every now and then, as I'm sure you're well aware, Dean, there are reports that the SSI, there are people who are scamming the system and getting SSI when indeed, with false doctor reports or whatever. Is that a huge problem? Is there a lot of people ripping off the system there or not?
Well, SSI probably has a higher rate of fraud, for the simple reason that it depends on conditions that are to some extent subjective, so someone says they can't work because they have this or that disability and, they get a doctor to say it. And, obviously sometimes that's not going to be true. So that will happen. I mean, I don't want to overplay that because I think the levels of fraud in the SSI program are also relatively low, but, clearly it's not zero. In case of Social Security, particularly the old age and survivors portion of the program, it's hard to rip it off for the simple reason, we know when you're born. So it's a little hard, to come in there if you're 45 and you tell them you're 62 and 65
right.
or whatever. So there's not a lot of fraud that way. There's always going to be mistakes. We have hundreds of millions of people in the system, and, those are going to work both ways, obviously. Sometimes they're paying people too much. Sometimes they're paying people too little. But, when people have tried to review it carefully and see, are people getting it who shouldn't get it, with Social Security, at least, that's a very low number.
Thanks, George, for your call. Adam in Gills Rock. Hi.
Hi. I have a question for you. Before you refer to the market, I think it was like $117,000, where over that amount, people that make over that amount aren't included in the program, if I remember right. And you said that the reason is because it's hard to track exactly how much they make because they might hide some of their money. I mean, to me, it doesn't really make sense. Why not attempt to, even if they make $5 million and they only claim $750,000, why not have them included in the program and try to get that money, even if it's not correct? And a second question I wanted to make, or a second thing I wanted to ask about was, has there been any attempts to try to fix the 2033 deadline, essentially, by upping the amount that they take out of payroll taxes?
Okay, very good question. First off, let me just be clear. The people who earn over the cap, over $117,000, they're included in the program. So it's treated, basically, let's say you had $117,000 as your annual income. I don't know if you do, but I'll give you the extra money if you don't. But we'll say that's your annual income. You'll be paying the same amount in and gain the same amount out as someone who earned $5 million a year. So they're included in the program. It's just that they don't pay the tax on amount above $117,000. Now, I'm all for saying, you know, let's raise that. The problem I wanted to get to, and I guess I didn't say it clearly, just to give me a good chance to clarify this. My concern isn't just that people are cheating. You know, people cheat. You try to catch them. We won't catch everyone. We catch some of them. But it's that they actually have legal ways to totally evade the tax. And just the simplest way I could think of, now, I'm not an accountant. I often say I have the Dean Baker five-minute rule. If I could think of a way around this in 5 minutes, professional accountants will take a truck through it. So here's my Dean Baker five-minute trick. I'm a doctor, very successful doctor. I have my own practice. I make $700,000 a year. So you tell me instead of taxing me on my $117,000, I'm going to tax me on my $700,000. Well, one of the things I could do is I can create Dean Baker's Medical Center, and that's a corporation. Okay, so what's going to happen is that corporation, Dean Baker's Medical Center, is going to get my $700,000 a year. It'll pay me $100,000 or so as my salary. But the rest of the money is going to sit as Dean Baker's Medical Corporation, and it'll be corporate income, not my personal income. And then it could sit there. They could pay me a dividend. You know, we don't tax dividends.
Mm-hmm.
I could sell it off, you know, have a capital gain. I could, you know, it'll be sitting there accumulating money. I could sell that off. Totally legal way. So I haven't even broken the law. I'm just found an easy way to evade it. So that's my concern when we raise the cap too high. I think we could easily raise it to 200, and, you know, some people do that, but not many for 200. But when you put it high enough, you're giving these high-end people who can afford good accountants, you're giving them a really big incentive just to play a game. Now, we could subject all income to it, but that's a different story. So, you know, my point is just we don't want to have a tax that the people we're trying to tax are just going to evade. We just create jobs in the tax evasion industry, and that's not helping anyone. Now, your second question was if people proposed raising the tax. There have been some proposals. I think, you know, people in Washington are very afraid of this, which, you know, on the one hand, I understand. You know, no politician wants to say, I want to raise your taxes. That generally doesn't work out well at election time. But I think, you know, 2 points I'd make about it is, one, I've seen a number of polls that show, you know, people understand Social Security costs money. And if you say at the end of the day, look, we'd love to have someone else pay for it, but, you know, the question is, do you want to see your benefits cut or do you want higher taxes? Most people do say they want higher taxes. The other point is that, you know, you don't have to have any sort of big tax increase at all tomorrow, and even at any point, it could be done very gradually. And I think the really important thing to understand here is ordinarily wages rise. We've had a long period where most people haven't seen rising real wages. And what always concerns me is we tend to focus on the tax side. Let's say that, you know, over the next 30 years, we raise people's tax by 1 or 2 percentage points. No one wants their taxes increased. But if people were getting their share of economic growth, their wages would rise by something like 50%.
Woo!
And people haven't been seeing that because all the money's been going to the high-end earners. Now, to my mind, that the idea that we're going to yell and argue and get real upset over the 1.5% in terms of taxes, rather than focus on the 50% in terms of wages, that's very backward. So if we have the wages, if people are getting their share of wages, on the one hand, that directly affects the program because that would directly increase the tax revenue. But the other point is if people's wages over the next 3 decades rise by 50%, you know, if their taxes go up 1 or 2 percentage points, you know, that's not a horrible thing.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Adam, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Social Security this hour with an emphasis on where it is now and where it will be and how to keep funding it, but also a discussion about the history of this very popular program in this country. Dean Baker is our guest, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org, and we always welcome your comments on Facebook, which are an interesting way to keep the conversation going after, well, right now, and when we're no longer talking about this issue, but on to something else. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, as the midterm elections approach, we found a very interesting paper about how voters develop their deeply held beliefs, even when those beliefs aren't truthful. We'll discuss how political advertising, media, and partisanship all play a role in how voters become misinformed, and that's tomorrow. So we hope you'll listen. Social Security this hour. Dean, here's a comment I hear all the time. So let's give it to you. This is from Debbie on Facebook. Well, I don't think there will be any Social Security by the time my husband retires. I'm not sure how old she is. It should have been privatized way back when.
You know, it's funny. People have done polls on, you know, people not thinking there'll be Social Security for them. And, you know, most people have been saying that for, well, at least 40 years. People want to believe what they want to believe. All I could say is that, you know, even if we did nothing, you know, I went through this story that, you know, the trust fund, you know, won't be able to pay full benefits as of 2033, assuming these projections are correct and there's no changes. That'd be a bad story. But even in that case, people would be still getting 75% of their scheduled benefits. And, you know, that's still going to be a pretty substantial payment. Now, I find it very hard to believe, you know, because I always go, you just go through the arithmetic. We're going to have a lot more retirees in the population come 30 years from now than we do today. It's pretty hard to imagine people getting elected to Congress and telling all those retirees, sorry, you're not going to get your full benefits. So the idea people won't get their full benefits, or the idea they won't get any benefits, you know, if we still have our democratic system, it's a little hard to imagine that. I mean, you were talking earlier, I was listening to the show about, you know, your Representative Paul Ryan running for re-election. I don't think Paul Ryan will want to get up there and say, I'm running for re-election, sorry, no Social Security benefits for people. So, you know, I could go through the numbers, but if you just kind of think of it as a common sense thing, you have members of Congress that want to get reelected. Are they going to be able to get reelected when retirees are about twice as large a share of their voting population as they are today, and they tell them, sorry, no Social Security?
Yeah, wouldn't be very popular. Lynn in Madison, hi.
Hi. Quick question. I have to believe that at least there's a percentage of retirees who would voluntarily reduce their benefit if given a simple option to do that, maybe annually or quarterly, to try to sustain or keep the system solvent longer. Has this been discussed? And is, you know, even a small percentage, of course, over if we start early enough, would extend the projections from, beyond 33?
You know, there is some option, and I couldn't tell you the details of it, but they do have sort of a formalized option. If you decide you don't want to get your benefit, you could say that and not get it. And I do not know what number makes that option. I'm quite sure it's a very small number. I don't know if there's a mechanism which you could reduce your benefit. Now, you can voluntarily make a payment to the federal government. I do not know if you could designate it be specified for Social Security. As a practical matter, I don't think it would be enough people to really influence the finances of the program.
Okay. Simply wanted to throw that out, but thank you for your time.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks for the call. Dave is next. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess where I come down on this Social Security thing is if you go back and look what's happened to the funds that actually we have paid in over the years, which I find curious, they now call it an entitlement, Social Security. It's been spent. It's been spent by both Republicans and Democrats. It's been put, at least I believe, into the general fund and replaced with an IOU. And then discussions, which you just had, about how can you imagine a representative getting elected if he said he was going to cut off Social Security, tells me that it's all political. And what I'd like to see is a system that's actually based on dollars and cents and revenues. And I think the only way that can be done, frankly, is to let us manage, not let us manage, but have that money in a private account so that when we pass away, that money could actually be passed on to our children if we didn't need it. How we transition to that, I don't know. But frankly, I, like many of my people I know, frankly, just don't trust the government anymore to do what's right. And there's plenty of history with the Social Security so-called surplus, which demonstrates that.
Well, you know, in terms of what was done with the surplus, it was done exactly as the law prescribes. They bought government bonds with it. So, you know, the people who say there was something misspent, no, that's exactly what the law says you're supposed to do. You're supposed to buy government bonds. And the government, you know, spent money, but that's, you know, just as if I were to get a $1,000 government bond, I sort of assume the government's going to spend that. I mean, they may not, but, you know, I would sort of assume that. But in any case, if I buy a $1,000 government bond, I expect if that comes due in 10 years in 2024, they're going to hand me $1,000. And practical matter, you know, since the U.S. became a nation, every single time that's been paid off. So that was a pretty good bet. And, you know, in terms of Social Security, I'd say the same thing. If you want an absolute guarantee, I don't think you can get it in this world. You know, if you could have your private accounts and that might make you feel better, but that's subject to politics, too, because guess what? We could raise your taxes. We could, you know, there's all sorts of things we could do so that money wouldn't be there either. So, you know, you're not going to get an absolute guarantee in this world. And, you know, practical matter is Social Security has paid every penny of scheduled benefits since it was created. And I think to most people, it looks pretty good.
Well, and you've got all these people who'd have to learn. I guess people would put money in the stock market. Well, there's no guarantee you wouldn't lose a whole lot if you put it privately in a stock market. Plus, you'd have to learn how to manage all of this by yourself. But there is a widespread belief among many people that I could really handle this a whole lot better than the government does.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I guess 2 points I'd make on that. I have 3 points. One is, you know, with Social Security, with the stock market, it's ups and downs, and, you know, you or I have to be worried about the timing of that. With the government, it really doesn't matter because, you know, we expect the government to be around pretty much indefinitely. So, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, we have a recession this year, the government could pay the benefits. You know, if the stock market's down, if we happen to be in the stock market and it was, you know, 2009, and that was when we were going to retire, whether by choice or, you know, because we didn't have a choice, we lost our job and couldn't get another one, you know, that would really be bad news for us. We've been saving all these years, and we just saw our money in the stock market lose half its value. So that's 1 point. Second is that there's very high administrative costs. When you look at private accounts, when you look at 401ks, IRAs, the administrative costs are on the order of 15, 20 times what they are for the Social Security program. So it's a lot more money that's going for managing. It's going to the people on Wall Street, the people who manage these funds. So that's a direct loss. Third point is, I think it's great, you know, that, you know, people want to manage their money. That's great insofar as people have additional savings. But the point of Social Security is to be a core retirement income. So insofar as people are knowledgeable about the stock market, they feel comfortable with it, they have the money to invest, I think it's great that, you know, I have a 401k. I'm really glad for it. It's going to provide a port part of my retirement income. But, you know, I understand that there's a risk there that's not with Social Security. So, you know, if it turns out I have some bad luck, I'm not getting very much money there, whereas the Social Security will be there.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave, for the call. Let's go to Susie in Monroe County. Hi, Susie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I know we are getting on some very important subjects about Social Security, but I wanted to tell you a little bit of history, too, is that my mother was one of the first 100 people in the United States to get her Social Security card.
Whoa.
And, you know, when you can look at the numbers on your Social Security card and they tell a history of where you got the card and your birth year and things like that, and hers was a lot of zeros. And when she would go
I hope you kept the card.
Yes, you have it?
Yeah, we still have it. It's very weird, I'll tell you. You look at it and you go, what is this? But she was very proud of it. She said that the president, she listened to the program or listened to the president speak, and she felt very deeply about what he was doing. So she went to the courthouse. She lived on the East Coast, went to the courthouse and got her card. And the only time, and you know, when you would hear people say, I've been paying into Social Security all my life. Well, she has. She had, you know. And the only time she ever said anything is that we had, in our family, we had farmers that were very poor farmers. And they did not pay into Social Security. So she did make the comment once that she was helping them stay out of the poorhouse. You know, it's a very interesting situation. And I did want to make a comment, too, about the man who in Monroe County here who was doing the history about our poorhouses. That I worked in those buildings. And the people who do work in those buildings know the history and are very respectful of the history of those buildings. But we tried really hard to make them happy places now, too, because they're doing such good work for our county just coming out of those buildings now. So. Mm.
And what did your mom do? What kind of work?
She actually went to the Andover Newton Theological Center in right outside of Boston. And she was in public relations and ended up teaching. And she... Little blurb here. She is the one who developed the newspaper and the classroom program for the education system in Wisconsin.
Oh.
So, yeah. And I have all her records on that, too, which is real interesting. But she was, you know, involved in government in one way or another for all of her life and very, very interesting lady. So, but, yeah, we have her Social Security card, and it's... It's interesting. So
yeah, thank you so much. Wouldn't it be interesting to find out who those people were, Dean? The first 100 to receive Social Security. I bet there are a lot of stories there.
It would be fascinating, you know, and I should know that it's famous, the first woman who received benefits. I'm just drawing a blank on her name now, but I'm getting a fascinating history lesson here.
Yeah, thank you so much, Susie, for your call. Barbara is next in, well, I'm not sure where. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a retired teacher, and I've always wondered what the WEP benefits that they eliminated were. Could he explain that? I think a lot of states don't have it for government workers.
The WEP, I'm drawing a blank on what exactly those stand for. Earnings, I forget what the P stands for. But the long and short, I'll try and make this as simple as possible. The Social Security benefits designed to be very progressive. And what that means is that if you didn't earn very much in your lifetime, you get a large percentage of that paid back. So just to take a simple number, let's say my average earnings over my lifetime was just $10,000 a year, I would get about 90%, about $9,000 a year back in retirement. On the other hand, let's say my earnings were around $100,000 a year, then I would get back probably about $40,000 in retirement, so only about 40% of my earnings. So it's designed as a progressive payback structure. Now, the windfall elimination provision, that's what the P stands for, tried to take account of the fact that you had people that worked both in the public sector at jobs where you didn't get Social Security and also might work in the private sector. And they're structured so as if you say you spent most of your life working as a teacher, which, you know, I gather is your case, but you also worked some time in the private sector at a job that did have Social Security, well, the idea was to not allow you to, in effect, take the advantage of this progressive benefit formula. So it takes back some of your Social Security based on your pension. I know my mother's in this situation. She worked most of her life for the state of Illinois, and she wasn't covered by Social Security, but she did have other employment, and she feels she's being cheated. I've tried to tell her she's not. I don't know what you'll think. But in any case, that's the basic idea there.
Well, you ought to be able to convince her as her son, right, who's involved in the whole area. But I know the story. Sometimes our moms and dads don't, you know, listen to us, huh?
Yeah.
But she should listen to you, of all people.
That's what I try to tell her.
I know. Well, we'll tell her the same. Dean's mom, listen to Dean. Barbara, thanks very much for the call. We have time for another comment if you'd like to join us. We went through all the phone calls, but we do. If you've been trying to get through, give us a ring now, 800-486-8655. I'm just interested, Dean, because I don't know too many people who are getting Social Security who think that it's not a good program. It seems as though people are very, very enthusiastic about Social Security once they start getting it.
Yeah, I think support for the program is very widespread. That's been my experience when I've gone around the country talking to people. Also, any number of polls always find this. And it's really across the board. It doesn't matter, Republicans or Democrats. You know, it's very comparable. They strongly support the program, young and old. Some differences, but again, very strong support. And even, you know, I've debated, of course, many people who want to change the program. I was out in Janesville, I remember, back in 2005, debating Representative Ryan.
Oh.
And he begins by saying, you know, I think Social Security is a great program. And he talks about he had benefited because his father died while he was still in school, so he had gotten survivor's benefits. And he says, you know, his argument is always, we want to preserve it, and here's how I want to change it. So, you know, so even though he was talking at the time about privatization, I have no idea if that's still part of his agenda, but it certainly was at the time. But he put that in the context of saving the program, not getting rid of it.
Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if we ever got an answer to, of all those proposals that are out there to keep things in good shape past 2033, do you have a favorite?
Well, I think raising the cap is part of the story, and I would also phase in some modest tax increases. You know, so, you know, if you increase taxes on the order of 1 percentage point on both the employer and employee over, say, 15 years, coupled with raising the cap to, you know, somewhere around $230,000, that should get you most of the way there towards, okay. We have a 75-year planning period, so get you most of the way. I don't know if all the way. We'd have to look at the numbers more closely.
Yeah. Dean, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. He writes for The Guardian Unlimited and Truth Out, Huffington Post, and he has a blog, Beat the Press, which is commentary on economic reporting. Author of Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show, and thanks to KP as well. for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead. I want to invite you to a special event coming up this September. It's a special WPR celebration in southeastern Wisconsin. On Thursday, September 25, I'll be at the Elm Grove Women's Club talking about what I have learned from 39 years doing broadcasts, which is over 10,000 interviews. Some amazing moments after that many years. You can meet me. My producers will be there. Other WPR personalities. I believe Larry Mueller is going to be there. We'll have dinner, silent auction, great local prizes, and you might even win some books that we've talked about. This is a book-loving audience. All of the details can be found at WPR.org/Milwaukee. It's WPR.org/Milwaukee, and the last day to register is September 11. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until tomorrow at the same time.